Welcome to a new episode of Becoming a Post-Growth Planner, Obstacles and Challenges to Changing Roles and Practices. My name is Christian Lamker, Assistant Professor at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And today we move a bit further geographically and also in terms of content compared to previous episodes, because I'm very happy now in early April 2026 to have Alejandro de Castillo with me. Together with two colleagues, we will get there. He has recently contributed to Post-Growth Planning Debates with an article in Planning Theory and Practice.
Hi, Christian. Thank you for having me. I'm here representing also both Yolanda and Jose Maria. And it's a pleasure to meet you. So we are an hybrid team and working from different parts of the world. I'm normally based in Colombia, but also traveling very oftenly to Spain, where we have like our main office.
We now talk as you are in Colombia, so quite a couple of hours difference between us, quite far that we move now to South America. In the first part now, I would like to get a bit to the paper that you've written together. The paper was called Reflections on Post-Growth Planning, Practices of Undoing, Deurbanization and Deconstruction, and Methodology for Eco-Social Transition, published in Planning Theory and Practice. Mm-hmm. What has brought you to write this paper? What has brought this author team together?
I think, well we are very, as I mentioned, a hybrid team. So it's myself, Yolanda, and Jose Maria. And I'm also part of an office called Nundo or Undo. And we work in the intersection of architecture, territory, and eco-social transition. And we explore like alternative ways of doing, again, architecture and urban planning, but with a very different approach, which is mainly focusing on not doing and doing and rethinking what already exists. This is basically towns and cities. And we work towards sustainability and eco-social transition. So what led to the paper? Well, I think that the paper, again, emerges from these concerns, our concerns and discussions on how post-growth debates remain largely theoretical, and even that, you know, like architecture and planning are mainly practical disciplines. In this case, there is a lack of operational frameworks and case study on how this, you know, and growth or post-growth theory it's turning to action.
Yeah, you went into quite a particular context with the Mediterranean coast and what you call the urban tourist growth machine. What do you mean by that? What is the situation there? How does it look like? Or what are also the major problems, local developments that you saw?
Well, we have focused on the Mediterranean coast, especially in Spain, and because we think this is a very, very the very perfect sample in a territory where a lot of contradictions are really more visible. You were mentioning, urban growth machines and we like to use this territory, and I think it fits really well the Mediterranean coast, because this was first introduced by Molotok and Logan, but it describes a very particular systemic condition where like tourism is not just leisure, but a driver of continuous urbanization. It's a main force also of capital accumulation. It really produces overconstruction and land saturation with infrastructures that really exceed social needs and serve to private urban development. And they kind of over-dimension territories, which is a barrier to what we believe architecture should be, which is something that transitions the actual situation to something socially and naturally sustainable. And so all the Mediterranean coast is a perfect example, as I mentioned, of this. And tourism is really locked into growth through like real estate speculation, again, political and social economical dependencies, and the financialization of land, and basically like mono-use, mono-functional activities, which also on the other hand brings a lot of fragility to the territory, as for example, like COVID-19 proved, with all these very specific touristic focused territories. We saw and through research that there's a big paradox between like actual sustainability policies that reinforce, you know, even if they don't want to, they reinforce growth and through efficiency and greenwashing. So we believe our approach is really working on what we call, well, like, you know, academics call it, like a strong sustainability and again, eco-social transition.
Our listeners will already notice, compared to some other episodes, we move quite far into detail, into architecture, into examples, and your paper also includes examples of, I quote, undoing in terms of the urbanization of deconstruction, but also renaturalization. So what do you mean by that, or how did it happen, and what can then also post-growth planning learn from these cases that you've studied in more detail, and that so far, and I agree with that, get less attention from post-growth circles?
Yeah, I think even if it's not really assumed like post-growth, or it's not really framed like post-growth, probably planning or even architectural intervention, we found that there are many examples, well, not so many, unfortunately, but there are several examples where we find these practices, like, as you mentioned, the urbanization can be assimilated to this classifying like land and, for example, removing infrastructures into coastal. I mean, we have an example in the northwest of Spain where this deurbanization is translated into the removal of infrastructures in coastal sand dunes in a couple of beaches. Then deconstruction can be interpreted as, you know, selective demolition with a lot of recycling and reuse of materials. And in this case, we have the example of the demolition of a touristic complex in Cap de Creus in the northeast of Spain, in this case, and the Club Med, like a vacation tourist complex with a lot of, you know, houses and stuff that has been completely demolished and the landscape has been restored. And also we have another case of renaturalization. I think these ones are the most common, and also like a natural consequence of either deurbanization or deconstructing, which is the renaturalization of wetland in La Platera, which is also east of Spain in a touristic place in the coast. I think what we can extract and learn from these examples, and I think this is the void that kind of the article covers, and it was the main motivation to write that article, and because part of our research is that we can learn that really transformation is possible even in highly urbanized contexts. So we can revert what is already done, and it's not, you know, not sustainable anymore. We can also learn that this is a difficult process, because change, when we talk about this kind of changes, is long-term compared to construction, which is really short-term. So change is long-term, it's conflictive, and also involves a lot of actors. So it's multi-actor, and it emerges from hybrid governance, which is also something very interesting. It involves a need to engage public institutions, civil society, and it's normally coming from bottom-up initiatives that finally are able to engage institutions. So I will say that, I mean, like post-growth planning and architecture, when it's translated into action, is not only about, you know, stopping growth, which is uncontrolled and unsustainable, it's not sustainable anymore, but it's also about reversing actively, you know, past spatial decisions which are not sustainable anymore. And apologies for using sustainable so many times, but, and I know it's a concept that it's been like manipulated in many ways, but that's why we normally in the article to introduce this concept of a strong sustainability, which is looking at culture, it's looking at social, it's looking at nature, and also at economics as well.
Thanks. Yeah, you had quite a team around that. And what you personally bring into that was the work also related to what you explained before, Nando, and your own work around doing, undoing, redoing. Can you take us a bit beyond the article? What is the core idea of that this different way of doing architecture that you are also proposing yourself?
Yeah, I mean, this began as a discussion among some friends and colleagues, most of us architects and planners. And at some point, we realized that architecture and planning was only about, you know, growing and how we are doing things, but not asking the real question of what do we need to do and how we can, you know, still continue building or doing things and being yet sustainable. And then we realized that there are some other very, very, I mean, strong tools that can be used. And we're completely out of the scope of the discipline. And so we, as I mentioned previously, we have, let's say, we have instrumentalized these ideas into operative concepts, because again, we don't want to stay like very theoretical. I mean, we think it's, you know, really core to think before doing anything, and theory needs to come first. But then we also want to make this, you know, this kind of ideas, we want to make them also something that is practical and can be applied into real life when either doing architecture or doing architecture and planning. So again, these three concepts are not doing, which means avoiding necessary intervention. And we believe this is something that architects and planners, I mean, are trained for. So it's not only about, okay, let's do this and how am I doing that? You know, talking about having this discussions, but what can we avoid or prevent doing and will really improve the environment? That's one thing. The other one is undoing, as something that, you know, it's removes harmful or obsolete structures, and well, redoing, which is I think more common. It's related more to recycling and reconfiguring systems in a more useful way. So that I think that the key concept here is shifting from architecture as production, mainly production, you know, producing things, to architecture as a decision making about intervention needs and intensity. So, and we really aim, because I mean the planet needs to, and this is something that, I mean, it's not really very arguable. We aim to reduce territorial, urban, and material metabolism. And we understand architecture that as something that is less about building and more about how we manage existing systems, how we enable economical and territorial recovery, which is needed in many cases, and how we redefine value beyond construction.
And imagine there was quite heavy debates involved around there and also conflicts.
I had,
What are the major obstacles, challenges that you faced or still face when bringing your thoughts to reality in discussions with different people, specific local places, your projects?
Yeah. I mean, we have you know, dozens of stories that we can tell about that, because we began this in 2011, so just 15 years ago. And at the beginning, it was a lot of, you know, confrontation, as you mentioned, like architects were finding this as a, you know, personal offense, basically, to their work. But yeah, to mention some of them, I think the main ones, or the most important ones, are the main one will be the paradigm, like the cultural resistance. So basically, because growth is embedded in our society, in architecture, and as a capitalism tool. And this was already identified by Donella Meadows, which I think we mentioned a couple of times in our articles in the 70s. And sometimes, and we also find this many times also in at the university, and when having academic debates, that not building or not constructing is often perceived as a kind of a failure, you know, of the process or what architecture is meant for. So I would say this is the main one. I like paradigm, like changing that paradigm, that main idea around architecture, growth, you know, happiness and progress, growth. That's the main one. Also, there's a huge institutional inertia. Again, planning, and I think this is very, not only, I mean, very specific and has a strong position in Spain, but it's not a Spanish thing. I think it's almost all over the world that planning is designed to enable development, and an opposite is not designed to enable, you know, repairing what already exists and making cities a better place to live, but also it's just enabled to produce growth and development and occupying territory. And then I will say that there's also a big conflict of interests, as planning and, you know, finance and money depends on growth. And this is very, and I think that's why tourism is a great example, and we use it in the article and in our research, because it structurally they depend on growth and new releases.
Yeah, can so, well follow the challenges, you know, the challenges you're talking about. But 15 years later, we are still talking about that. So it means it's possible.
Yeah, and I think one of the most valuable things that Andu does is that we have demonstrated through the years, through different projects, with some of them have been, you know, recognized in different competitions and through different prizes, is that you can bring value to the territory by not doing, undoing, or redoing. And but again, you know, this whole approach is, let's say, politically unpopular and basically counterintuitive. And it's also linked to what we teach at university. Will still architecture practices about how we do things and not why we do things or what things should be done and which ones shouldn't be done. And also, I think on top of that, this practices, and if you just do a bit of investigation through these examples I mentioned, or the ones we present at in the article, are really slow, are legally very complex, because they sometimes need of new methodologies, new laws, new tools, and again require a lot of consensus across like different actors and interests, which are not easy to, I mean, first of all, you need to sit all the people at the same table. And then, I mean, reaching consensus is something that it's been difficult sometimes and takes a lot of time.
Yeah, we're already deep into some of the frictions and problems on the way. And I mean, that's also reason, I think, why we are talking, to spread a bit more the discussions and have an open conversation about what are the issues at stake, but what are also future lessons to take away from that.
Yeah.
And I would like to get a bit more to the future lessons now, but first looking at what were the frictions that you really had when taking the post-growth perspective to such an environment, like you explained, the overconstructed coastline, a long history of intensive building since at least 1970s, 1980s. Yeah. So that's more than a small thing.
It is. I think when you look at tourism theory and planning, you see concepts as over-tourism, you know, mature territories, saturated territories. And as you have mentioned, this is the main friction, one of the main frictions that we have. We already have a lot of territories that are completely fully built. And some of those, or much of those, are sometimes not even legal because they were built many years ago. Some are in very fragile you know, sites, really fragile to now climate change and climate events. And they are really, when looking at, you know, energy consumption, energy production, energy needs, basically they're completely and not sustainable and really challenge eco-social future. So that's the main friction. What do we do with all those territories? Then we have another, you know, a lot of obsolete infrastructure serving many, many of those territories, like, I don't know, highways, you know, energy plants, dams. So that's one of the main questions. What do we do with those territories? Then the second friction, and I already mentioned it, and I think that's a very interesting debate, and also that generates a lot of controversy when we have, you know, bring this point into at universities, that we architects and planners are really trained to build. That's what we train for. That's the aim of the discipline. So we are not trained to delete or to redesign or to reduce, remove, restrain, whatever. And again, like, growth really operates short term with immediate results. That's something that you know people and especially politicians really like, because they can take a picture of the whole result of the construction. Ecological recovery requires a lot of long-term thinking and action and consensus. So I think those three points. I mean, there are many others, but those are the main three. And again, that it's linked to what I was mentioning previously of how we change that big paradigm of architecture is building. Building is growing. Growing is welfare, and it's also progress and happiness, which is not the case in many examples. So yeah,
you really touch very high on the terms in terms of leverage points on getting to the paradigm level, and a lot of your work touches upon really changing the paradigms of growth, progress in architecture, planning, and so forth. But what should we then take forward for the future of architecture and planning? What maybe also positive message of hope do you have for our disciplines?
No, we have. I think it's important to mention that with the methodology, with the tools, I mean, we have developed kind of new tools for a new paradigm. And I think that's important. And I think the article proposes a methodology which is based on studies from Daniela Meadows and her team in the MIT. And I think this is not really, well, it's a methodology, but more like a thinking framework with, again, it's a structure in the paradigm, which is values, ideas, and worldviews. And this is what will bring a lot of change, but it's very difficult. I mean, it requires a big effort, but also then we have, procedures or strategies, which are rules and governance and flows, which again is, like kind of a sweet spot between like big change, but also easily to action. And then we have like specific actions, which are really concrete interventions. So all these three levels of the thinking framework will provide transformation, and we have to try to do those three in a simultaneous way. Though we have to I think focus on the paradigm, which should be generate a lot of change. And I think this methodology, or we believe this methodology, is works because it connects really theory with practice, and also allows comparison between case studies and also focus on leverage points, for the systemic change. And so after, challenging this methodology in different projects and studies, you were asking about key lessons. So what key lessons can we extract? I think that we can talk about three leverage points. Again, the one is the paradigm shift. So moving from anthropocentric growth to ecosystems is something foundational, and it's important to think that we are not alone. We live in an ecosystem, so what we do affects everything. So that's an interesting shift of paradigm. Then we need to develop the classification and legal tools for changing land status, and this is a powerful planning instrument. And then we need to think of, hybrid governance models. As I was mentioning before, many of these examples and many of these cases that we are researching emerge from bottom-up pressure, and some then institutional action that is somehow triggered by this bottom-up pressure. And again, key lessons. So we need to reduce urban metabolism. So this methodology can do that. It has proved useful in this way. We need to restore ecological functionality, and we need to redefine planning objectives beyond growth. And so I think this is something that we can do now. And I mean, it's not impossible. It's completely possible. And it's just shifting, like moving from all this, a lot of this theory and turning that theory into specific tools, as the one that we mentioned in the article and we are discussing today, to do this change.
Yeah, we are already much more into doing than into demanding compared to some other works, and also very deep into the problems that then occur when dealing with the reality of what has been built over decades. And also in your comment article, you finish by building a retroactive manifesto for post-growth planning. How can we envision that? And what is then a lesson for a practitioner in urban development and planning, maybe already tomorrow? So what can I do? What can I do now?
So I think the retroactive manifesto brings a lot of, you know, hope, in the sense that we can do planning and architecture in a different way. And we want to emphasize that we look at existing practices and recognize them, which is probably the main gap. It's not that the practices don't exist, but they haven't been framed as or recognized as, even by their own authors. So we are recognizing these existing practices as post-growth planning. And we can learn from them what realistic timelines, again, slow, but then realistic, we can plan, you know, having in mind that we need that timelines. We can deconstruct and find actionable strategies and new governance models. And we can say that the manifesto, it's aiming for, you know, moving from projecting ideal futures, which are, you know, mainly unrealistic and serving, again, growth in one way or the other, either through, you know, green, fake green strategies, or even, you know, efficiency, which has proven something that favors growth again. So moving from this, you know, ideal futures, and we don't consider what's going on now and what the main problems are, towns and cities and territories. So moving from that scenario into learning from real sustainability transformation that is already working. And this is what this case studies really show, that we already have this. I mean, there are examples that are very that have proven good, you know, the methodology, and that have proven that it is possible to do planning and architecture in a different way, and that really, you know, this new way of doing things, it's working towards this eco-social transition that we really need, because I mean, the planet is, as we know, it's not infinite, and you know, we continue doing things as if it was so.
Yeah, thanks for taking me and us into all your experiences and projects and thoughts. I would love to hear even more of that. But as we now reach almost half an hour of talk, I think we should come to the closure, and then also to the very end, move to ask you to finish the sentence, post-growth planning is for all of us.
Okay, so please let me just literally read. Yeah, our approach would say, or would define post-growth planning as applying an approach that prioritizes the reduction of territorial and material metabolism, promotes the restoration of ecological functionality and the reconfiguration of social spatial systems through an ecocentric paradigm, mainly by undoing rather than producing the built environment.
Thank you very much, Alejandro. Many thanks from me here from Europe to South America to Colombia, and have a nice rest of the day.
Thanks a lot, Christian. Thanks for having us. And again, just to say that I'm part of a big team, and great to share our ideas here with you and with all the people listening and to the podcast and watching the YouTube video. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.